So we're in the seventh and last point of the seven-point mind training, the precepts for mind training. Precepts, again, are a collection of slogans that help us to support, help support and nurture our mind training practice. And just before lunch, we were looking at this adopt the three principal conditions, which were to find a qualified teacher, then to put their instructions into practice, and then also to gather conducive conditions for practice. So these were the three principal conditions. Is there any questions left over on that before I move on to the next point?
Does teacher, other than the qualities you already explained us to look at, like we have our titles like Geshe or Rinpoche, do we have to see something like that as well? Or like someone with the academic qualifications like you can be? I'm confused with it.
Well, remember the word Rinpoche meant precious one, and that's given to someone who they've identified as some high-level practitioner from a previous life. Technically, that's what it means, but again, just because someone's called Rinpoche this, Rinpoche that, doesn't necessarily mean that that's actually the case, because, you know, so we need to still check them out. The word Geshe, here in our mind training text, of course, it was Geshe Chikawa. So the word Geshe, Ge is short for Gewa, which means virtue, and She is short for Shenyin, meaning spiritual friend or friend. So Geshe was virtuous spiritual friend. And that in Sanskrit was Kalyanamitra. And historically, someone was a Kalyanamitra or Geshe meant they were a qualified teacher of Mahayana. These days, in the modern day, Geshe is simply an academic title. Only that. So typically, if a monk spends many years of study, maybe 10 to 20 years of study, and then has passed some academic exam, they're awarded the title Geshe. So if someone's called Geshe something now, it's purely academic title. Historically, around particularly at the time of the Kadampas, if they had the name Geshe, it definitely meant they were a qualified teacher of Mahayana. So again, just because someone's called Geshe something, you can be fairly sure that they've done a lot of study and they've passed some academic exams, but whether or not they're a qualified teacher, we have to check them out. Even if someone's called Lama something. Lama is usually translation of guru. And guru in Mahayana Buddhism, at least, means qualified teacher of Tantra or Vajrayana. And again, if someone's called Lama this, Lama that, these days, I think that title Lama is used very generally, so it may not mean they're a qualified teacher of Tantra or Vajrayana, so you need to check them out. So whether they're called Lama this, Geshe that, Rinpoche this, check them out. Okay, then let's move to the next point. So here we are in the middle of page 125. Contemplate the three that are free of degeneration. So what are the three things here we need to avoid degenerating? It says here, since all the attainments of the Mahayana depend upon the student's faith and respect towards his or her teacher, make sure you never are divorced at any time from the perception of your teacher as a Buddha. In this manner, make sure your faith and respect toward your spiritual teacher remains undiminished. So this is the first point, to not allow it to degenerate, to maintain our faith and respect for our teacher. The second point, furthermore with the thought, this mind training teaching represents the quintessence of Mahayana and is like a potent seed of Buddhahood. Engage in this incomparable practice. Thus, make sure your enthusiasm for mind training remains undiminished. So that's the second point, is to make sure that our enthusiasm for this practice does not degenerate. The third is, as for the pledges of the great and lesser vehicles that you have taken, so that is the you know, the pratimoksha vows, the bodhisattva vows, and so forth. You should, by sailing the great ship of shame and conscientiousness, which are the true antidotes, learn to guard them undiminished, not tainted by even the slightest infractions. So again, the third point is to make sure that we maintain these pledges and commitments, that we maintain this ethical basis for our practice, and so not allow them to degenerate. So these are the three points to not allow to degenerate, to maintain faith and respect for our teacher, maintain enthusiasm for our practice, and maintain the precepts and commitments that we've taken. I think that is fairly clear. Any points there? Yeah.
Let's say that we broke one of these three points.
Yeah, like you went against one of your commitments.
One against, yeah, or a lack of respect for, for one's teacher or something like that. Is there any practice or something to do?
Yeah. I mean, you have, particularly with terms of the vows and commitments and precepts, usually associated with each of those sets, there are specific practices that you can undertake to sort of purify or restore them. Yes, absolutely. And of course, if we, you know, lose faith and respect for our teacher, then we need to see why that is and either restore it. Or maybe it's because we've realized that teacher is not really a valid teacher because we never checked them out properly. Then in that case, we should maybe finish our connection with that teacher without condemning them or looking down upon them. Just say, well, sorry, and cut from the teacher. So in that sense, if we lose the faith and respect in the teacher because we've actually realized they're not qualified, that would be the appropriate thing to do. Well, then we need to overcome that, and because the teacher, of course, is the one who is guiding us in the spiritual path, so we need to work on restoring that faith and respect to our teacher.
Is there any particular verse one can read in order to do that, or is just like...
Well, there is within the Mahayana, there are these, you know, nine ways in which we can look upon our teacher, the nine attitudes. And so that's a short text. And so that is very helpful for understanding how to relate to the teacher and then and the reasons why. So that could be helpful. Yeah. Okay. Then we move on to the next point down the bottom. Be endowed with the three inseparable factors. And this, I think, is going to, is very straightforward. It just means to be, make sure that, we're always, we're never separated from engaging in virtue with our body, speech, and mind. So let's look at the commentary anyway. It says, make sure that your body is never divorced from such virtuous acts as offering services to your spiritual teachers, making offerings to the three jewels, offering torma cakes to Dharma protectors and elemental spirits, making prostrations, performing circumambulations, and so on. So basically just means make sure that with our body we are engaging in virtuous activities. Make sure that your speech is never divorced from such virtuous acts as reciting verses, taking refuge, repeating mantras, doing recitations. So again, to use our speech, to make sure that our speech is used for virtuous activity. Make sure that your mind is never divorced from the two awakening minds, of course, wisdom and compassion, as in endowed and is endowed with inconceivable courage to vanquish all the conceptualizing afflictions, such as self-cherishing. In brief, make sure your body, speech, and mind are never divorced from virtuous activity at all times. So I think that is fairly straightforward. So let's move to the next point then. Train constantly toward chosen objects, the chosen objects. So here it's going to mention two particular objects that we should place particular emphasis on in our practice. And so let's see what those two objects are. It is stated that being angry and vengeful towards enemies and adversaries who are right there in your presence comes about on the basis of frequent interactions. Thus, from one angle, there is a real risk of losing your mind training in relation to those who simply appear repulsive, those who harbor ill will against you, even though you have caused them no harm, and those who you find undesirable, even though they harbor no ill will toward you. Therefore, single out these people for special focus and train your mind by perceiving them as parts of your own heart. So again, this is talking about the people who we normally find difficult, is that we need to particularly single them out, because if we don't, then often these difficult people overwhelm us and create a lot of negativity in our mind, and we react with hostility and anger and so forth. So we need to pay particular attention to these people so that we do not allow that to happen. And on top of that, of course, these very people are the ones that are really kind to us in terms of helping us to develop patience and compassion and so forth as well. Then the second object is mentioned here. Furthermore, because your spiritual teachers, parents, and bodhisattvas are objects of special significance, the fruitional effects are inconceivably grave if you accumulate negative karma in relation to them. Single them out, the special focus, and engage in training. So here we're talking about the second object is those people who have benefited us immensely, our teachers and particularly our parents. And so that we should also, because they've benefited us so much, if we do harmful actions against them, that creates very strong imprints in our mind. So we need to be careful not to do that. So also we may need to pay particular attention to these sorts of people who have benefited us immensely in our life, to not to engage in any negative behavior toward them either. So to summarize that, again, I'd like to read a little bit from Alan Wallace's book here on page 265. I think here he only talks about the first of those two, the adversaries. He says, the distinctive ones referred to here are those who arise as your adversaries, like thorns in your side. Dharma practice can fall apart when tested by those who harm you and those whom you resent. Meditate constantly on those distinctive people. Bring them to mind. These people provide a test. When your practice is going well, you may come to the conclusion that you are a holy person, maybe a bodhisattva. But it is meeting people who harm you for no apparent reason that really tests the strength of your practice. Distinctive people are the ones who help us by showing us what we need to work on. So I think that's a very nice little explanation. Anything on that point? Again, I'll just keep moving if there's no questions. I think most of these are fairly straightforward.
Honestly, see, what I've observed is from the last time, also when I came to Kushita to reading, if I'm able to maintain a certain practice, something new I'm trying or something attempted for first 15, 20 days, it does get inculcated in me. Now, as a thought of going out from Tushita is passing my mind that I will go, the issue that happens is immediately what blows my top off at the moment I go out is everybody asking, what did you do at Tushita? And from searching from tragedy in my life to thinking that something has gone wrong with me to asking me to teach them meditation over phone, everything is possible in those 3 days. And at that very moment only, I think I tend to give up and say that, my God, leave me alone. And
oh, because everyone's seeing you as their savior or something.
Savior or some subject of tragedy. Something has gone wrong. In
oh, because you came here, you must have had some tragedy. Because only people who have tragedies have come to these places.
So, at the very moment, I think if I'm sure because it happened the last time round. If my phone is off, office, the moment I go, 10 people, my God, where have you come from? Where were you? Where were you?
Well, then just say you went for a holiday.
No, but my phone is always on 24/7.
So ah, the fact that it's been off.
So they would know that I've gone somewhere. So where were you?
Well, you just say you went for a holiday in the mountains. You know, you had a little bit of relaxing in the mountains, you know. I mean, if you really feel that they're going to annoy you, then, you know. I mean, of course, if they're genuinely interested, then we can, you know, say we can mention a few things. And sometimes it's really actually, even though they behave like that, sometimes it's really a sign that they've really got some problems themselves. And they're sort of, you know, they're wanting some solution and they think, well, maybe you've sort of found some solution and they're interested, no? So sometimes it's because they have some genuine interest.
In the Indian context, there is no privacy. I mean, most of my relatives and everybody will know about it. As to where I have gone, so if I've told 2-3 people, at least 20 of my relatives know about it.
And what, is there something exactly that really irritates you about that?
No, I mean, the moment last time I went out, I had in the office at my desk, I came, I had 3 people standing by my side like that, wanting to know. Then at lunchtime, I had special 3. Another 3 whom I had not known also, one boss of some other department. it's so, I mean, I can't explain the experiences in that fashion. And then there's somebody else who said, how was it, and wants to know my phone or teach me, help him over phone, how?
Well, then you can say, why don't you go and find out yourself and give the email, give the website of Toshita and say, there you go.
It's difficult to handle it.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, I think we don't have to sit there and explain everything. I mean, you can. You can simply say, well, here's the website, you check it out and go there yourself and you may find some help there. We don't have to spend all day explaining everything to them.
Probably you can see those adverse conditions as your test from the day one.
Yeah. So
I would probably see like that.
Yeah, so I mean we don't need to be obliged to spend all day trying to explain everything to everyone. I mean, of course, we don't need to be irritated or hostile towards people because, I mean, sometimes it's just maybe idle chatter they're looking for, but sometimes I think people who come, you know, particularly I understand where you've gone, are actually genuinely interested because they probably have also lots of problems and are looking for some sort of solution. So if you can just sort of casually mention.
Even that, even if you give a passing reference, they'll say, oh, but my experience and my view, and then it goes on a very different, as if you're speaking English, just speaking Greek. He'll tell you all about, a lot of people will come and blabber about their experiences, which I can't even relate to. I mean, some spiritual practice or where and which country.
Well, then I think we could just use our skillful means to not allow this to turn into some sort of just idle gossip for the whole day. I mean, yeah, I can understand your situation, but I think if we can sort of give a quick, simple answer to them, to give them something, you know, the website address or maybe some book to read or something, that might just satisfy them.
I can actually give a very small story of this one because my family is here in India as well, and I had a similar scenario when I left home that 10 days course here. All my aunties and uncles were just gathering together, surrounding me, and they wanted to know. And I believe that was a good test for me. So,
sure.
Even my mother as well. And
sure.
Even though they don't understand what the concepts are.
Sure.
But I think it's not like I'm not trying to self-praise, but I was trying to use my patience. And I sat with a couple of them, and I tried to explain them, like, this is how I'm seeing this. It's not a religion like you guys do. So this is, I'm going as a philosophical point of view.
Sure.
And I think after half an hour, half of them were not bothering me after that. Rather, I had a very nice meal.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
I mean, often that's true. I mean, often they're not that deeply interested. So if you give them a few tidbits, then they're happy.
They were just thinking that I got some sort of magic wand and I'm going to go and give it to them.
Oh, they thought that you'd brought back a magic wand for them.
Mantra or something which will help them to
Yeah, yeah, okay.
When I explain them, then they
okay.
They picked a few things like how to meditate and kind of things. But most of the other stuff wasn't relevant. They left me alone very quickly.
Okay, let's move to the next point. Do not depend on other conditions. To engage in other spiritual practices, it is essential to gather various favorable conditions such as food, clothing, and so on, and also need to have good health, access to water that is suited to your body, and no excessive disturbances from humans and non-humans alike. The practice of mind training, in contrast, does not depend on such conditions, since the very absence of favorable conditions is itself a resource for this spiritual practice. Today, take all of these as the ripening of meritorious karma and as factors conducive to mind training. So again, what it's saying here is that in general, of course, we talk about having the necessity for conducive conditions for spiritual practice. And even here, of course, as we saw in an earlier point, we try to gather these conducive conditions for practice. But here in mind training, just because we don't seem to have these conducive conditions doesn't mean we can't practice, because we can take all conditions into this practice of lojong. So here we don't have to rely on conducive conditions to be able to practice. Of course, that does not mean not to try to have these conducive conditions as a beginner, because as a beginner, it would be helpful to have some more conducive conditions. But if we happen not to be able to get those, we can still practice, no matter what the situation is. Then if we move to the next one down the bottom, it says, engage in the principal practices right now. So here is a list of six things. There are two alternatives. One is more important than the other. One is the principal practice. So let's have a look at these lists here and see which one is the principal of the two. Since beginning this time, you have roamed in the three lower realms of existence as if it were your ancestral home. Today, at this juncture, when you have obtained the human existence of leisure and opportunity that is so rarely found, even in a billion eons, instead of making all kinds of plans for this life, it is more important to engage in Dharma practice that aims for the welfare of future lives. So here the two alternatives is to engage in spiritual practice or Dharma practice, or to get caught up in the eight worldly concerns. So here it's saying the principle of the two, of course, is to have a meaningful life, to adopt spiritual practice rather than simply chasing after wealth and pleasure and so forth. So this is the two here. The second pair is coming. It says, of the two aspects of Dharma, exposition and practice, the latter is more important. Meaning that when we talk about Dharma, and the word Dharma actually has many meanings, generally it's talking about the teachings of the Buddha, and here we can talk about two types of Dharma, the Dharma of scripture and the Dharma of realization. So the Dharma of scripture, of course, is all the instructions, and that is what is here called exposition. And then practice is how much we have internalized those instructions or teachings. So, of course, the principle of those two is the Dharma of practice, of realization. So this is the principle of the two, that just having teachings will not liberate us from suffering, but if we put those into practice, we internalize them, that is the primary of the two. So that is the main one of the two. That, of course, doesn't mean that we need to forget about teachings and we forget about study and so forth, but the main one of the two, of course, is the practice. Compared to all other meditative practices, the practice of training in the awakening mind is more important. So here, the two alternatives is the training in awakening mind in bodhicitta, so wisdom and compassion, so emptiness and bodhicitta, And on the other hand, then other meditative practices. So, of course, what is the main, the principle, is the core practice of wisdom and compassion is more important. Of course, we're not saying that we then don't do any of these other meditation practices, but the main practice is the wisdom and compassion, the two bodhicittas. Compared to training the mind by applying the two paddles of scripture and reasoning, it is more important to persistently train in applying the appropriate antidotes on the basis of your teacher's pith instructions. So here we have the two is to either use the scriptures or to use the direct instructions from the teacher. So, of course, the direct pith instructions from the teacher have been tailored according to your specific requirements. So this is the principle of the two. So this is the more important, is to follow those direct instructions from the teacher because they have been directly tailored for your specific needs. And then it says here, compared to other activities, training by remaining seated on your cushion is more important. So here, then, the fifth pair is meditation versus doing other activities. So again, here, the principle is the meditation because we need to internalize these ideas. We need to bring them into our mind in order to be able to make those other activities more meaningful. So the main one here is the meditation practice versus doing other activities. Of course, that's not saying we don't do other virtuous activities, but the main point is the meditation here to transform the mind. And then the last pair is compared to avoiding the objects of your afflictions, it is more important to probe within. So what this is saying is that if we are faced with objects that provoke mental afflictions, then one approach, as I already mentioned as a beginner, is if that object really overwhelms us in a negative way, it may be a good short-term strategy to avoid that object. But of course, more importantly, the principle is to be able to deal with that mental afflictions due to the object. So that is the principle of these two, is to really to probe within and to confront the mental afflictions and apply remedies to them. So these are the six pairs in this point here. And so in each of those pairs, one was the more principal than the other, more important than the other one.
I'm facing a problem there concerning that sitting on the cushion is more important than all other activities. Current situation in my life. My brother is a very, very good person.
Mm-hmm.
Doing all the good stuff, like he's a nurse now, he's becoming a doctor, he's been working in the Congo, he's been working in India, he's doing all, spending a lot of time to go and help people. And he literally wrote me in his last mail, and I wrote, yeah, I'm going to India, and oh, it was an amazing coupon, and he literally wrote me, he's hoping I'm not going to spend my time in India doing 100,000 prostrations in places in Maha or something, example, but doing something useful, because I'm a teacher and I can do so many useful things with my time. And he didn't know that I'd come here. And
yeah.
Oh, damn, when I come back home, he asked, what did you do in India? I was into Shita, sitting on the cushion, meditating, speaking about compassion. He would just say, you could have done something sensible with it. I know I can't defend what I'm doing here or explain it, but still it sounds...
But then you could... Then you could use the following argument, which I used earlier, you know. Then you could use the same argument saying, well, don't spend 6 or 7 years to go to medical school because you're not helping anyone. You're wasting your time. You better go out now and be an aid worker.
The problem is he has been an aid worker. He's studying medical school, working at the same time in the hospital. Like
right.
Sure.
But I mean, so even he can understand that by going to medical school, he can be more effective in helping others. True?
Yeah, that's why he's doing it.
Correct. So that's what this point is saying here. is that if we meditate, we can be more effective in helping others. That's why it's more important. It's not saying that therefore we need to meditate our whole life and don't do anything else. No, this is not what it's saying. The point is, if we don't internalize wisdom and compassion, we can be only very limited in how we help others. If we meditate and internalize it, we can be much more benefit to others. So in our entire life, it would be maybe, if we take the whole life as an example, it probably would be much better to spend 6 years in medical school and then so many years really benefiting others versus not going to medical school and spending those extra 5 or 6 years trying to help others. Which one would be more effective? Maybe the medical school, if we had that capacity. So I think this is what it's sort of saying here.
Yeah, I hope you didn't start. And you could spend 3 months in Bulgaria, working there in the health.
In the clinic, yeah. So yeah, sure.
I was wondering, why did you get the point?
Yeah. No, it's fine. No, it's okay. No, I mean, that's good. Okay, let's move on to the next point then. Do not apply misplaced understanding. So here again, we have, I think, a list of 6 pairs of one thing which is misplaced understanding. One is the correct thing, the correct way to understand. So here we have, it says here, this refers to the avoidance of 6 misplaced understandings. If instead of enduring hardships entailed in Dharma practice, you forbear difficulties when seeking the objects of your desire, nurturing friends and subduing your foes, this is misplaced forbearance. So forbearance here means that instead of having forbearance and patience within our spiritual practice, simply we have forbearance in terms of trying to accumulate more wealth and fame and so forth. So this is misplaced forbearance, that we really need to cultivate forbearance and in our spiritual practice trying to improve ourselves as a person. If instead of aspiring to purify your negative karma as much as you can, accumulate merit as much as you can, and arrive to transform your thoughts as much as you can, you view the excellences of this life in admirable qualities and aspire to them, this is misplaced aspiration. So here, misplaced aspiration is instead of aspiring to transform our mind, to develop qualities, to purify our negative behavior, instead of that, aspiring to that, we aspire to the 8 worldly concerns. We aspire to generating as much wealth and pleasure and praise and good reputation as we can. The third pair, it says here, if instead of savoring your experience of the Dharma through striving in learning, reflection and meditation, you savor the taste of sensual desire and pursue it, and you dwell on and relish memories of past sexual experiences and triumphs over enemies. This is misplaced savoring. So here, misplaced savoring, of course, is to savor sensual pleasures and savoring also having defeated enemies and so forth, instead of savoring hearing, contemplating, meditating, and practicing and in trying to improve ourselves as a person. Then the fourth one is misplaced compassion. It says, if instead of cultivating compassion for those caught in suffering and its conditions, you have compassion for those who undergo sufferings as part of their ascetic life and meditative pursuits, this is misplaced compassion. So that means instead of having compassion for those who are really caught in suffering, we start actually instead of that, we have compassion for those who go through difficulties in improving themselves in the spiritual practice. Then the fifth one is misplaced dedication. So it says here, instead of cultivating dedication to Dharma practice as a privilege, you have a sense of dedication to such endeavors as accumulated material wealth, nurturing friends, pursuing mundane greatness. This is misplaced dedication. Same idea. Instead of having dedication to Dharma practice, to improving wisdom and compassion, a more meaningful life, we dedicate ourselves to the eight worldly concerns. If instead of rejoicing in those, from the Buddhas to the sentient beings who engage in virtue and enjoy its fruit, happiness, and rejoice when you rejoice when misfortunes and disasters befall your adversaries, this is misplaced rejoicing. So instead of, again, rejoicing in our own and others' virtues and good actions, you rejoice in the misfortunes and sufferings of people who we don't particularly like. You should relate to these six misplaced understandings with appropriate avoidance and affirmation. So I think that, again, that's fairly straightforward. So let's go on to the next page. Do not be sporadic. And this is sort of the idea of that the continuity is the key to success in our practice, to have continuity. At times you practice mind training, while at others you engage in mantra repetitions, and on some occasions you favor, forsake both, yet on other occasions you guard both. Relinquish such a sporadic approach. Forsake also such sporadic approaches as sometimes making plans for this mundane life and increasing negative karma and afflictions, and sometimes engaging in Dharma practice for the sake of future life. Without being sporadic, engage in Dharma practice with single-pointed dedication. In particular, practice mind training, for mind training is the innermost essence of Dharma practice. So again, it's basically saying that if we want to progress in our practice, to not be sporadic, meaning not to do maybe a huge amount of meditation one day and then nothing for the next week, but rather have a continuity of practice to make sure that we are continually practice evenly, and then we will achieve some progress and results of our practice. Similar to that, the next one, train with decisiveness. When a minor nerve is damaged, you treat it by cutting it clean. Again, maybe that's some old Tibetan thing, I'm not sure. In the same way, when you engage in the training of mind, do not remain hesitant, but direct your entire mind. You should remain resolute in your decision and train with no hesitation. Avoid such, it's a nice word, dilettantish attitudes as, first, I will check to see if my mind training is beneficial. If not, I will recite mantras. This indicates you have failed to let go of yearning for self-centered happiness. This kind of practice can't even overcome sickness or malevolent obsession. So again here, to really make sure that we train with decisiveness, that we really have a strong motivation to practice and put all effort into our practice. Then the next point, be released through the two, investigation and close analysis. First, investigate which affliction is most dominant in your mind and earnestly apply its specific antidote, striving hard to subdue the affliction. Then analyze the way deluded mental projections arise in relation to the objects that act as their bases. By applying the antidotes, you reduce the force of the afflictions or prevent their arising. By repeatedly thinking, from here on I will never allow my mind stream to be tainted by these afflictions, you cultivate familiarity with the protective armor for the future. Thus, with these twin methods for applying antidotes to past and future afflictions, strive diligently to eliminate the afflictions. So here, it says you're released by the two, investigation and close analysis. So investigation here means to investigate and see what mental affliction is really dominating our mind, and then apply the antidote to that to subdue the mental afflictions. And then analysis is then on that basis is to see how our mind is coming up with that mental affliction in the first place, to see how we are coming up with inappropriate attention. And by doing this analysis, This can also help reduce the affliction coming up by, for example, understanding and analyzing and seeing, you know, that we are generating attachment because we see there seems to be a lot of beauty in the object, and coming to see, actually analyzing that there is no beauty to be found in that object. So by analyzing the mechanisms by which our mental afflictions arise, that can also help to circumvent them arising in the first place. So by both doing both investigation and analysis here, we can not only recognize the mental afflictions and apply antidotes, but we can circumvent them coming up in the first place. Yeah.
The analysis part, is it like watching which patterns create those habits?
Yeah, I mean, yes, to where these mental afflictions are coming up, why they're coming up, you know, in terms of the objects and how we are misperceiving the object. So the mechanisms for how that comes up. Particularly, we talk about this inappropriate attention, you know, how we are maybe exaggerating the qualities or exaggerating the faults of the object and so forth. And doing this sort of analysis can help circumvent the mental affliction coming up in the first place. So then we go to the next one. It says, do not boast of your good deeds. Don't be boastful and arrogant towards others on any grounds, suggesting, for example, that another person is indebted to you and that you engage in certain spiritual practices, or that you are learned, or that you are industrious in your ethical discipline, or that you are a great, or and that your family lineage is excellent. Radrengpa is one, again, another one of the early Kadampa masters, has said, don't place too much hope in humans. Supplicate the gods instead. In any case, if you have correctly distinguished between enemy and friend, you understand everyone to be a friend. Then even when you work for others' welfare, the jaundice of self-centeredness does not arise. Instead, you recognize all such tasks as obligations, so boastfulness towards others simply does not occur. At this point, your mind has become trained. So again here, not to boast of your good deeds, because that's a sure sign that we're caught up in the eight worldly concerns, that our mind is being caught up by the self-cherishing mind. And again, if we've correctly distinguished between enemy and friend, and we can see that our real enemy is our self-cherishing mind, then we would not even have the the idea of boasting about our exploits and how wonderful we are. Yeah. That I think others' welfare, working for the others' welfare. That I think that's what the other tasks is. And well, I think any virtuous activity. So if we're doing this, instead of being boastful about it, we'd simply just do these tasks because of the mind of cherishing others is our real friend, cherishing others. What about job interviews?
Usually there is a sense that one needs to sell himself in order to job.
Yes, and of course, if we deceive and lie and say we've done all these things we haven't, we have all these qualities we didn't, maybe we get the job, but then it becomes apparent to our employer that we're not really that qualified, and then they may just let us go. So, of course, if we do that deception, we have to continue to do that deception, you know, and so that is quite stressful and not a very good state to be in. So, in a job interview, of course, we can, you know, honestly put forward the things we've done and the qualities that we have and what we could bring to the company and so forth, for sure, of course.
What would be the line of trying to boast about someone's quality versus...
Well, to be accurate, not to exaggerate. No? And I think also if people are very boastful, the employer can sort of sense that a little bit and maybe not so comfortable that this person is sort of having this sort of, you know, boasting this big-headed attitude, because, you know, maybe they can see that this person then maybe not a team player and maybe not good for the company and the team, because they're sort of, they're just looking out for themselves. Maybe they can sort of sense that, I think, in the interview, and then maybe they say, well, maybe you're not the right person for our company, because you probably won't fit into the team and you create a lot of disharmony in the company or something. And of course, if the person can sense that you're exaggerating, they can maybe sense that you are not really being completely truthful, and then they're not going to be very happy to employ someone that's being a little bit deceptive, I think. Where often I think that in those sort of interviews, if two people are equally matched, I think the one who's really being very honest often will get, if the person who's giving the interview has a good state of mind, they'll maybe often pick that person because they see they're being completely honest. Maybe even talking about a few things they're not so great about. If they can really come across that way, that they're really being open and honest, then maybe they will, even though they're evenly matched with the other person, maybe they'll get the nod, because that's the sort of person you'd like to have, you know, an honest, open person in your team. Okay. Do not be ill-tempered. Whatever others may have done to you in the past, such as humiliating you or verbally abusing you, the blame lies within yourself. So what does that mean, the blame lies within yourself? The blame for any suffering that you experience from that lies within yourself. Because if someone is verbally abusing you, those words of verbal abuse are just some sounds hitting your eardrum. The reason you suffer is because of your self-cherishing mind. You react to that. So this is what it means. The blame lies within yourself, is that the blame for any suffering you experience is because you're reacting to that. We can simply not choose to accept any words that they mention. Do not react to others with contorted facial expressions or abusive words. Even with your mind, restrain yourself from ill-temperedness. Because your Dharma practice has not yet become an antidote to self-grasping, your resilience at the present is at present weak, and you are volatile due to ill-temperedness. Since such behavior makes your Dharma practice ineffective, ensure your Dharma practice becomes an antidote to self-grasping. So again here, to not get ill-tempered, to not even mentally react if this is the case, if someone is verbally abusing you, because then we, by developing that ill-tempered state of mind, then of course that's going to lead to probably reacting and saying something abusive ourselves, and then our sort of practice has really fallen apart. So again here, to not react, and even to use this difficult situation to help develop further our wisdom and compassion. Do not be fickle. This means not displaying erratic responses to every situation out of a transient temperament. This causes great inconvenience to your companions and must therefore be relinquished. So again here, I think this means to be not temperamental and try to be very consistent in the way in which we respond to situations. Otherwise, if we are very erratic in our responses, that's going to maybe create some difficulties with our companions. Do not be boisterous. Avoid seeking fame and praise through expressions of gratitude for assistance that you may have rendered others or benefits you have brought them. In brief, do not desire even to hear compliments for help or assistance rendered to others. So here, we can read a little bit from Alan Wallace, what he says about this point on 271. He, instead of do not be boisterous here, he calls this do not yearn for gratitude. If you want acknowledgement for any good that you have done, you are missing the point. Do not expect others to reward you with their gratitude. Just release it. In the practice of Tonglen, no gratitude is expected from the person we bring to mind. Not expecting anything back is part of the practice's transformative power. Practicing Tonglen opens your heart and mind, opens your Buddha nature, and therein lies happiness. No need for gratitude. The practice is its own reward. So that is the last of the 57 slogans. And now we have a little summary. So let's go to the summary. In this manner, you should train your entire life in the two awakening minds by means of both meditative sessions and practices in the subsequent period. So again, the main practices are the two awakening minds, wisdom and compassion, emptiness, bodhicitta, and to effectively practice those, we need to internalize that in meditation and we need to integrate that into our daily life, the subsequent periods. There will then be no basis for dispute and no reason for conflict with the gods, demons, or your fellow humans. By making the gods at peace, the serpentine nagas tranquil, and everyone happy as best as possible, when your last breath approaches, you will experience the beginning of true happiness, and you will turn your back on misery and travel from light to light, from joy to joy. The practice or benefits of these spiritual practices are presented in the following. So here we have two more short verses at the end. The first one is, through this proliferation of the five degenerations, transform every event into the path of enlightenment. So it's said that we are living in this degenerate age, and there are five degenerations, and that because of these five degeneration, things are very difficult in our life, but because of this very fact, we have then a lot of opportunity to use these difficult situations and transform them into the path to enlightenment. So let's have a look at this, and then I'll briefly mention what these five degenerations are. Generally speaking, the teaching of Buddha Shakyamuni emerged during an era when the five degenerations were on the rise. So maybe actually now is a good time to mention the five degenerations. First one is degeneration of time. So degenerative time, meaning that it's a time of much fighting, sickness, and also a time of a lot of spiritual poverty. The second one is lifespan. Degenerating lifespan. Of course, we see in the very moment in the world history, it seems that in general lifespan is a little bit increasing. But I think here, over the longer term, it's said that the lifespan is decreasing. The third is view, meaning tendency toward wrong views in our life. The fourth degeneration is the afflictions. And that is, degenerating afflictions means that our mental afflictions are increasing, and it certainly seems like in our modern society that our mental afflictions seem to be really on the increase. And the degeneration of sentient beings, and here it's talking about in terms of gross suffering and also this mental distortion, mental afflictions as well, within sentient beings. So these are the five degenerations that are talked about here in the text. So if we go on, it says, in particular, it has emerged during this present age, the era of the last 500-year cycle. So it's sometimes taught in the text that we're going through these 500-year cycles where things are changing over these 500-year periods, when the degenerations are even more severe than the previous, than the five, the degenerations are even more severe than the five degenerations. That doesn't really make sense, but because of this, sentient beings have only afflictions in their thoughts and only negative karma for their actions. They relish when others suffer and feel anguished when others are fortunate. So with all these, with all three doors, body, speech and mind, sentient beings indulge only in deeds that are harmful to others. It is therefore an era when harmful sentient beings have gathered. Furthermore, those non-human agents that admire the positive white force have departed to the pure realms to benefit bodhisattvas, whereas the strength and force of those who admire the dark side have increased. Because of this, misfortunes plague sentient beings. Today, therefore, a multitude of adverse conditions cause all kinds of suffering for sentient beings, and myriad obstacles particularly befall those who put the doctrine into practice. So at this time, when adverse conditions compete to form a thicket, if you do not train in the spiritual practice, though you may enter other systems of practice, you will fail to succeed in Dharma practice. By entering this practice and striving in it, on the other hand, you will transform all adverse conditions into factors conducive for training in the path to enlightenment. So what it's saying in this whole section is that now that in our society we are faced with so many difficult situations, then this type of practice of mind training can be most, most beneficial, because here we have then the ability to transform these difficult situations into the spiritual path. As for other benefits, a year's pursuit of virtuous activities during this age, when the teachings of the Buddha face hostile threats, will accomplish the accumulation better than eons pursuing virtuous activities in pure realms. So what this is saying, and we can sort of understand that, is that if we have easy conditions versus we're trying to do the same thing in difficult conditions, then the benefit we receive by doing that when there are difficulties will be much stronger. Because of those difficulties, we can, that means it's, the benefit we receive from that action is greater, because we're striving in those difficult conditions. Therefore, those capable training the mind are not vulnerable to the proliferation of the five degenerations and remain contented. If you know how to train the mind, even your body, the body of a mind training yogi is known as the city that is a source of joy. For all happiness of this and future lifetime of self and others comes about on the basis of this very body. Strive therefore by concentrating all your efforts in this endeavor, and if you make sure that the teachings are integrated with your mind, and that the rule of Dharma is established as firmly as a stake driven through your heart. That's another Tibetan sort of saying. And that you experience the taste of Dharma. Before long, you will attain the perfect state wherein the complete aims of self and others are accomplished. Thus said the master. So the master again is Geshe Chikawa. So here then we have a quote from Geshe Chikawa itself. It says, to illustrate these points in a definitive formulation, the author himself wrote the following lines. So this comes within the 7-point mind training, these four lines. And this is from Geshe Chikawa himself. Because of my numerous aspirations, I have defied the tragic tale of suffering and have taken instructions to subdue self-grasping. Now, even if death comes, I have no regrets. With these words were uttered as an expression of joy by the highly accomplished yogi Chikawa, who, having presented the method of practice, arrived at a decisively settled state of mind following a clear discrimination between enemy and friend. So that is the end of the commentary. Now I'd just like to finish this. I'd like to read. Oh, you got a question about this?
Yeah. Yes, sure. Thanks, Greg. In relation to these five degenerations, vegan degenerate types, depending on what way you look at that, that can be a bit hard to accept, given the standard of living. And I know we have problems, and the world has problems today, but this has been expressed in the context of the 11th, 12th century.
Yes, but it's said that from the time of the Buddha, these degenerate times have been existing from the time of the Buddha. And they talk about these 500-year periods of change, and I think we've just about entered another one of those now. So these degenerations are not just something that it was at this time, that is something that even from the time of the Buddha is present. And actually, when we look at most of these, maybe except the second one, is a lot to do with mental degeneration. Yeah, I mean, of course, second, temporarily now we have a sort of a slight increase in lifespan, but also we can see at the time now there are also now a lot of very serious illnesses that are now cropping up that threaten to maybe wipe out lots of people, you know. So this is not certain that this is going to continue to increase. So, but the rest, a lot of the rest are mainly to do with the mental afflictions.
I find this kind of reconforting to think about, because I often think our ancestors are bad and capitalism and all the bad stuff happening. And I look at the text which has been written 1,000 years ago, nothing has changed. I look back 2,000 years. Time of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire made huge ecological destruction left in the Black Death, and I don't know what. So it's all the generation. I don't mean that it should stay like this.
No, yes.
A corporate thing, well,
it's not just a modern problem. Okay, I'd like to just read a little bit from here, from Alan Wallace, just to finish off the text, the commentary. He says the following: the key to spiritual maturation is transforming all of life, adversity included, into spiritual practice. The 7-point mind training, a synthesis of teaching and practices developed over hundreds of years during the flowering of Indian Buddhist civilization, is wonderfully effective for cultivating the two bodhicittas during the course of an active way of life. No method other than embracing all of life, adversity, suffering, and joy, will be effective when there are so many obstacles to spiritual practice. And now he's talking about Dilgo Khyentse again. Dilgo Khyentse was one of the greatest modern-day masters in the Nyingma tradition. Passed away, I think, 25 years ago. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche's final teaching to his Western students was the 7-point mind training. He was a master of the profound teachings of Mahamudra and Dzogchen. Yet of all the teachings he knew, this mind training was what he most wanted to leave us with. In his own words, so now he's quoting from Dilgo Khyentse himself. So Dilgo Khyentse was saying this: there exist many teachings, profound and vast, such as Mahamudra and Dzogchen. But our capacity is small. We are without perseverance and lack sufficient respect and devotion to be freed through teachings such as these. Nevertheless, if we practice this mind training, we will experience great benefits. It is an extraordinary instruction, the very essence of the Bodhisattva teachings, and has been praised again and again. Therefore, let us practice it without distraction. This was the final testimony of Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. So maybe he has some good ideas. So we have now completed the text. Any last questions? Because now I have a couple of announcements to make. We have to be careful when we say there's no good or bad. Nothing is inherently existent, but of course there are things which are beneficial and which things are harmful. We have to distinguish these things. Yeah, I mean, what we've can understand from these teachings in particular is, of course, from a Buddhist perspective, good and bad means beneficial or harmful. And there's not anyone that decides what's good and bad. What is beneficial and harmful is something in harmony with the interconnected nature of reality or not. If it's not, it's harmful. If it is, it's beneficial. And so, of course, for us as an individual, yes, at our level, it would be difficult to know if certain behavior or actions is beneficial or harmful. But then we use our wisdom and compassion to try to evaluate that as best we can. In that sense, that's all we can do.